Hello everyone and welcome to Margaret Beaufort Omnibus Edition, episodes 13 to 15. Now, in 1483, it is difficult to be sure about Margaret's attitude towards Richard. But as I have said, despite early negotiations with him and his desire to keep Stanley on his side, I figure that Margaret's distrust of Richard would have come very early. Certainly, later on, her view of the king would be extremely dusty. What is also difficult to know is what Margaret's ambitions for her son were in 1483. A strong strand in Margaret's reputation rests on these years, 1483 to 1484. The antiquarian John Stowe, he believed that Margaret was at the centre of plots almost immediately after Richard's coronation. S.B. Crimes, the modern historian with the most impronounceable name, described Margaret as the chief spinner of plots. But what was her strategy? Was she simply unconvinced that Richard could be talked round, as Edward IV had been, to consider the idea that Henry Tudor could be rehabilitated as Earl of Richmond? Or had she begun to consider the idea that with the princes in the Tower taken out of the equation by the petition announcing Edward IV's illegitimacy, that the boy was as much of a contender as Rocky ever was? Whatever, the first sniff of rebellion comes very early in July 1483. We don't know much more other than that there was an owl in the fen. Essentially, Richard's usurpation had been fast, effective, and the potential leaders of any resistance had been totaled very quickly and very effectively. Whether you're a Richard fan or a Richard foe, you have to admit that much. So, the mid-level Edwardian supporter, the gentry, those who had done well by the household of Edward IV, were miffed but leaderless. But the antiquarian John Stowe suggests that the owl in this particular fen had planned to set a fire in London. And while everyone was milling around yelling fire and has anyone checked the bakery in Pudding Lane, the princes would be sprung from the tower. In this plot, Margaret was apparently complicit. And the follow-up was to be that Jasper and Henry Tudor would ride into town, presumably on white chargers, and put Edward V back on the throne again. The plot was initiated by four relatively lowly members of the household, including the pardoner, and his tale includes the dismembership of the four, unfortunately, for treason after they were discovered, and a rising of 50 people. Now, I'm not going to lie to you. As far as I can see, the level of involvement of Margaret is a bit uncertain. John Stowe doesn't actually mention it. Jones and Tallis, Margaret's most recent biographers, they both suggest that Margaret was involved, but both reference only John Stowe, who again doesn't mention Margaret's involvement at all. So I'm left thinking that maybe this supposition of her involvement is based on the fact that the rebels wrote to Jasper and Henry. And I suppose that would strongly suggest Margaret's involvement, because it might be tricky to send a message addressed Henry Tudor somewhere under lock and key in Brittany. Richard, however, clearly did not suspect Margaret of involvement. John Stowe probably had access to an indictment which has been lost, and the indictment clearly doesn't mention her at all. So, there are some doubts, it must be said, about Margaret's involvement in this very early rebellion. But if it is true, it says something rather interesting about Margaret. Since the plan was freeing the princes and setting them up in opposition to Richard, it suggests that her first instinct was not necessarily one of ambition for her son to be king. And it would suggest no desire on her part to get rid of the princes. It suggests, indeed, a revulsion specifically for Richard III, and Margaret would not be alone in that, it has to be said. As a general observation, it seems very hard to attribute actions of characters in history to their finer feelings or morality. We tend to look for practical reasons. But whereas some would have swallowed Richard's protestations that his brother's marriage was illegitimate, many saw it for what it was. If Margaret was involved in this plot to free the Pinches, it would also square with the accommodation that she had made over many years with Edward IV, where her ambition was no more than to get her son back and into society as the Earl of Richmond. It may well be, not only did she feel repulsed by Richard's murderous, illegal and ruthless seizure of power, but that she felt Edward V would be much better disposed towards Henry than Richard. Though I don't suppose she could have been sure, though time would tell, that Richard would much prefer Salome to have been involved in all of this, do a quick dance of multiple veils and pop Henry Tudor's head on a silver dish. But if Margaret had helped free Edward V and pop him back on the throne, he'd surely have been grateful, right? I may be building a house of cards on this one rather disputed report, but if it was true, it also suggests that Margaret was a rather wilder, more willing to take risks kind of person, and to be brutal, less bright and more impulsive than her reputation. Seriously, a plot by four relatively lowly household servants doesn't sound like a banker to me, but I have the advantage of hindsight, I guess. Anyway, Richard's reaction was to pull the princes completely out of the public eye. Their personal servants were dismissed, and Dominic Mancini reported that the princes were no more seen in the grounds, no more came to the Mariner's Hollow. It began to be assumed that the princes were dead. Now, we have been through all of this on the History of England. We have even had a healthy debate on Richard III, but I recognise this is an emotional issue. Who killed the two Cock Robins, Edward V and his younger bro? For this podcast episode, ladies and gentlemen, we have but one matter to consider. Was or was not Margaret Beaufort the murderer of small children? Because I am well aware that there is a strong following for the Margaret as a manipulative, unscrupulous murderer. The argument for Margaret's conviction runs like this, I think. First of all, motive. Can we think of one? Well, the argument goes that with the boys out of the way, the genetic pool was beginning to look awfully shallow, Yorkist-wise. It might well have occurred to Margaret that Henry was now third in line, and one of those, Anne and Richard's little boy Edward, was terribly young. And we know how common infant death was back in the 15th century, do we not? And it was rumoured and even assumed that Anne could have no further children. So, bit speculative maybe, but we do know Margaret was capable of taking risks. Also, it might be that Margaret saw this as a great way of discrediting the regime, if nothing else. While we're not aware of any pop-up displays outside the Beaufort residence saying, "Have you seen these boys with this man?" or angry articles in the Daily Broadsheet from MB demanding that Richard produce the boys unharmed, we do know that the grapevine was at work and that the prince's deaths were widely assumed before the end of 1483. Margaret could possibly, perhaps, maybe, have been one of the whisperers, though we have no evidence. But before we get too hoity-toity about how speculative all of this is, we know for sure that Margaret wanted to get rid of Richard because she plots with Buckingham to dethrone him later. And she does, in the end, help. And she does, in the end, see Henry onto the throne. Hope that's not a plot spoiler. Okay then, what about the means? Well, Margaret and her husband were close to the centre of power. Surely they could have organised access. Not so, loser, it is argued. Richard didn't trust Stanley as far as he could throw him, and Stanley was a man in love with the pies, so that's not very far. And Mancini tells us the boys had been incarcerated and were heavily defended. Well, this in fact is all we actually know from what Mancini tells us. All the attendants who had waited upon the king were debarred access to him. He and his brother were withdrawn into the inner departments of the tower proper, and day by day began to be seen more rarely behind the bars and windows, till at length they ceased to appear altogether. Now that doesn't mean the dungeon door had been slammed on them. Furthermore, the tower was a busy, bustling, working royal palace, and it's quite possible the princes were relatively accessible to the right people, especially if we banish the idea of the evil Richard planning their murder. as to that Stanley point? Well, as we know, Stanley and Richard had form, but in this new world, Richard's palms in fact became distinctly sweaty when he considered the possibility of Stanley deserting him. So he had consistently blandished since his coronation, blandished for England. So Stanley might well have had considerable latitude. And in terms of opportunity, well, I think it's super unlikely that Margaret slipped a dagger beneath her wimple, cut the princess's throats and dipped her hands in their bloody intestines while singing the Marseillaise. But it is entirely possible that she bribed a member of the royal household. The Stanleys had a bob or two, after all. OK, so how are we doing? Now, Margaret's biographers, unsurprisingly, have set their faces firmly against the very idea of Margaret being involved in their murder. Nicola Tallis even lets a smidge of outrage slip out. The suggestion that Margaret was in any way involved in the murder of the princes is frankly ludicrous. My dad used those words once, the only time a member of the Leicester branch of the Crowthers has appeared in the press. When asked by the glorious Leicester Mercury about the roadworks, he said, "The situation is ludicrous. Gosh, we were so excited and proud. The Leicester Mercury, for crying out loud, the Leicester Mercury." Dad treated his massive and immediate fame with quiet dignity and restraint, it has to be said, keeping Rudyard's words in mind. "If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same," and so on, you know. Anyway, why does Nicola Tallis take this view? Well, firstly, she points out that no contemporary source at all accused Margaret of complicity in the boys' murder, not even Dickon of York. The first accusations don't appear until the 17th century. Also, as far as Tallis is concerned, Margaret has just been involved in a plot to free the princes. Seems thoroughly illogical to then plot to kill them all. She then makes the point that access to the princes must have been heavily restricted. Even if not planning to kill them, they were in a very sensitive position after Richard's coronation, and he would not have wanted them to escape or become the focus of a rebellion. And finally, Tallis appeals to Margaret's character. She had surely shown no sign whatsoever of being the kind of person who could order the death of two small boys. She was a woman of great piety at the very least, and I've always believed God doesn't approve of killing small boys. Jones and Unwood, by the way, do not even deign to mention the possibility of Margaret's involvement, so fatuous do they consider the idea. There is, of course, the alternative possibility that Margaret killed the princes after Bosworth Field. I have never thought the ideas, though, of the princes surviving that long, home or abroad, very likely, and the escape and living happily on a sun lounger in the Barbados theory, I've always considered to fall into the mad conspiracy theory bag. So, look all, you know my opinion. I, sadly, and despite being a lifelong Yorkist, am of the opinion that only one of the candidates undeniably had the opportunity, the motive and the means. And for me, the most obvious answer is the right one, namely that Richard III was a nephew murderer. I appreciate there are problems with this analysis, but it's the best fit. And under the theory beloved of sci-fi writers, Occam's razor, Richard wins. But for a full and frank exchange of views, please visit episodes 188 to 193. So don't have a go at me, but please do come to Facebook site and state your opinion. But please, no mention of sun loungers. However, there can be little doubt that Margaret was unhappy with Richard's reign one way or t'other, whether she was thinking of her son as king or just as Earl of Richmond. And equally, there's no doubt that for once Margaret was in the mood for rebellion and was at the centre of the web in plot spinning. She had spotted Richard's weak spot, and it was in ego. Not Richard's ego, but in the mainstay of his regime, that of the Duke of Buckingham. You might wonder why the Duke of Buckingham would be a good target for plotting. After all, he'd been at Richard's side from the very off, plotting, scheming and all of that. And when Richard rolled the ball and got a strike, Buckingham was the one that picked up the chicken and chips from the counter at the alley, richly rewarded. He could not have been more powerful without actually being king himself. And yet, Buckingham was being worked on. Buckingham was having doubts about supporting Richard, though it's not entirely clear why, given the gold and goodies with which he had been showered so far. There are a couple of possibilities, and these possibilities may be connected with the presence of Dr. John Morton. John Morton was the Bishop of Ely and was one of the many of Edward IV's counsellors who had fallen under the suspicions of good King Richard when he seized the throne. But cutting the head off a bishop was not straightforward, not even for Richard. So, rather than remove said organ, Richard had sent him home in the care of the man that he could trust more than life itself, his partner in crime, Buckingham. In the summer of 1483, after what we might agree had been a very busy year, Richard went north to the homeland of Yorkshire, land of the free as it's known, as well as the land of dripping, to see his son Edward. 9 years old, Edward was given a chariot to ride in to meet his dad, which sounds like every nine-year-old's dream to me. Buckingham, meanwhile, went home to Brecknock in Wales. There, Morton started to mess with his head. Morton probably worried aloud about, what will people think about Richard's usurpation, I wonder? Gosh, he might have suggested, the gentry south of the Thames, they really loved Edward IV very much. They loved their roles in his household. Now they've got nothing to do, poor dears, hanging around at home. Well, I figure they must be seriously grumpy, and I bet they're up in arms about whatever's happened to the son of their king. Not that I'm accusing Richard of anything, you understand. But you know how people talk. But, he might have sighed heavily, though there are many of them, they have no leader. So, maybe Richard can afford not to worry, but if a leader appeared, well, things could get nasty, you know. And then Morton may have pointed out, there are all those Woodville lot. The Queen and her family, they have a big affinity. And the Woodvilles and the Greys, and they must be seriously upset. Given the right leadership, Richard had better be careful and watch his back. Morton might also just possibly perhaps have happened to casually mention Henry Tudor and Jasper too. Richard himself had in fact started to turn his head towards Henry and Duke Francis in Brittany. He'd briefed his envoy to start discussions with Francis, and although Henry was not specifically targeted, it does seem the topic did get raised in discussion. And then Francis began playing his trump card with enthusiasm. Oh, he said, I have the King of France constantly in my lugs about that Henry Tudor chappie. He's making me fantastic offers. I have a good mind to let him go to France. As it happens, said King of France died in August 1483, which rather took the pressure off Richard. But meanwhile, Morton was able to explain to Buckingham that, look, Henry could appear at any moment with the support of either Brittany or France. Richard had better be scared of that too. So Buckingham must now have been in a right old paddy, and it appears that he had rather taken Morton to his heart, for Morton later appeared by his side as his counsellor. And so now silver-tongued Morton dropped the last bit of poison. Buckingham himself later explained that Morton had reminded them that, oh, you know what? I'd forgotten that you yourself, you have a claim to the throne. You're descended from John of Gaunt. Now, I might tell you, gentle listeners, that the chance that Buckingham had at any point in his life forgotten this would be precisely zero, zip, a non-chance that had shuffled off this mortal coil and gone to meet its maker. 14th century nobles did ancestry. Big time. But there we go. Buckingham's pretty little head had been comprehensively turned. Now, at this point, you're probably wondering, I thought it was Margaret who was supposed to be the spinner of plots. Well, Margaret was indeed ploughing the field of rebellion, but she was working a different strip. She could herself bring rebels to stand on the headland. Her relative John Wells and other lords, such as Thomas Lewknor, John Cheney, John Heron. But it would not be enough. So she had another target, This target was incarcerated in Westminster Abbey's sanctuary, the Queen, Elizabeth Woodville. By this stage, Elizabeth would probably have been pretty desperate. No one likes to be trapped in a church for more than an hour, however good the sermon. It was probably dawning on her that her two boys' lives were either in danger or indeed already lost. And since Richard had persuaded her to give up her younger boy to his care, that must have driven her mad with agony. Elizabeth stood at the head of an extensive affinity. She could in particular bring Thomas Grey, the Marquis of Dorset, to the table, and Lionel, the Bishop of Salisbury. So, if she could be persuaded to join the rebellion, her support could swing it. But how to have that conversation? One does not just walk into Westminster Abbey. Or not to go a-plotting with Elizabeth Woodville, you don't. It just so happened, though, that Margaret, being one of the tippy-top of the elite, used one of the very tippy-top physicians in England, whose name was Dr. Lewis of Caerleon. Another of Dr. Lewis's clients was, spookily enough, Elizabeth Woodville. Everyone was used to Dr. Lewis's face around Westminster, and so Margaret took a risk and took Lewis into her confidence. And to her relief, she found him ready to conspire. Lewis took a proposition of alliance to Elizabeth. If she supported the rebellion against Richard III in favour of Margaret's boy, Henry Tudor, succeeding to the throne, she would commit to a royal mariage. Elizabeth's eldest daughter, also called Elizabeth, Elizabeth of York, let's call her, to Henry Tudor. So, if all went smoothly, Elizabeth of York would be queen. Woodville really didn't have much going for her as it was, and so she agreed to roll the dice and agreed to recruit as many as she could to the cause. Margaret then enlisted her faithful and long-time servant, Reginald Bray, a man very close to her, but with the personal authority to be able to talk to gentry families. Bray urgently started conversations, recruiting members of Edward IV's household like Giles Daubeny, Richard Guildford, and others. Meanwhile, Margaret was desperate to get Henry into the loop and had the perfect man for the job, a cleric called Christopher Urswick, who had probably come into her patronage via Stanley. Urswick was being primed to get his bottom over to Brittany and get Henry to sign up to the marriage idea, and for he, in his turn, to bring his own bottom over to England to lead the rebellion and claim the throne of England as his birthright. Before Urswick could leave, however, John Morton got in touch with Margaret, and he urged her to send Bray to Wales, where he could meet Buckingham as well. So it's not exactly clear how it all happened, but somehow Buckingham and Margaret got to hear that they were both plotting at the same time, and they really should get it together. There was, of course, an elephant in the room, and that elephant was called Who's Going to Be King Then? We don't know what deal was struck, but the balance of opinion seems to be that there was hoodwinking going on, ladies and gentlemen, hoodwinking, and that the winker behind the hood was Margaret, who led Buckingham to believe that he would wear the crown. In Brittany, meanwhile, a different envoy did arrive from Margaret, one Hugh Conway, and he brought with him for Henry a good deal of money. Henry had approached Duke Francis and asked for aid. Despite Richard's advances, Francis saw the benefit in having the new King of England in his debt, in addition to which Henry now came with money. So he agreed to fit him out with ships and with troops. Henry sent word back to Blighty, and it seems that by the 24th of September, Henry and Jasper had heard directly from Buckingham. There would be two centres for this rebellion: Buckingham's estates in Wales, calling out his affinity and his tenants, and the south of England, starting in Kent. Meanwhile, Henry would sail and land, probably in Devon in the southwest. And Henry did indeed set sail in the 3rd of October, but the weather was not kind. Nevertheless, he tried again, though he'd been looking worriedly at his watch, fearing he'd missed the whole event. But this time he managed to make it over the channel, although he was blown off course eastward towards Poole in Dorset. There, soon after the 18th of October, he saw a crowd of soldiers on the beach. He sent some of his own men to investigate, and they were greeted with good news. Yes, yes, come ashore. The rebellion is working like a dream. In fact, the rebellion was not working like a dream, or at least it was from a Ricardian point of view. There seemed to have been just too many moving parts, and somewhere along the line, one of those moving parts was squeaky. So, Richard knew something was up and had the time to issue commissions of array in multiple counties in the west. Meanwhile, the risings in Kent and the south of England went off half-cock and were poorly coordinated. And while Richard had kept his eyes firmly on the main man, Buckingham, his trusty lieutenant, the Duke of Norfolk, dealt efficiently and successfully with the southern counties. Meanwhile, the heavens had decided to teach Buckingham two lessons. The first is that if you're planning anything from, I don't know, a family picnic, or let's say a rebellion involving marching hundreds of miles to defeat a usurping monarch, costing hundreds of lives in the process, don't trust the British weather, and particularly the Welsh weather, which makes England look like the Sahara by comparison. The heavens opened. The River Severn rose, and Buckingham's loyal tenantry floundered in the mud. Richard's agents had also done a good job. As Richard and his main force approached Salisbury, Thomas Vaughan had already captured Brecon Castle, and Humphrey Stafford had wrecked key bridges over the Severn, leaving Buckingham unable to cross into England. The second lesson was that Buckingham should have been reading his Bible, where he would have read that, "For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap." Buckingham was a hard-driving, exploitative landowner, and his tenants roundly hated him. So, rather few came to join him and John Morton. And when things went swimmingly in terms of rain and mud, they legged it. A crash of drums, a flash of light, and Buckingham's golden coat flew out of sight, and he was left alone. Looking at all the options and future scenarios, Buckingham decided to run away. He was, however, quickly found and caught and taken to Richard's camp at Salisbury, where he begged to be able to talk to his old partner in crime. Richard requested only that he talk to his hand, and Buckingham was executed in Salisbury on the 2nd of November. Let's return then to Poole Harbour on the south coast and Henry and his welcoming committee. According to his biographers, Henry showed excellent judgment, supposedly around the 20th October, let's say, in suspecting the intentions of these men of Dorset, who were indeed actually disreputable, dishonest types who really wanted to capture him and take him to their leader, Richard III. So Henry sailed away with his small force, ending up back in Normandy. Now, given the date, which is just about when Buckingham was raising his army and had yet to crash and burn, wouldn't it be fair to say that Henry, rather than being a model of sagacity, was something of a model of wimpiness? As far as he knew, the game was still in play on the 20th of October. His loyal partners in rebellion were out there risking their lives, and he sailed off at the first sign of trouble for a nice cup of tea and a bun. Not sure I'd have been very pleased were I a rebel. However, one biographer, S.J. Gunn, gives a later date, the 30th of October, for Henry's arrival. So let's save Henry's blushes, shall we, and assume that it was indeed this later date, since by then the die would indeed have been cast. Interestingly, Henry ended up in Normandy rather than Brittany, that channel crossing again, Tusk. I say interesting because it meant he had to ask Charles VIII of France for the right to cross his lands to walk back to Brittany. Which Charles did, actually, with quite a lot of goodwill and a bit of cash to make the journey more pleasant. Henry continued on back to Brittany, though, suggesting that he very much trusted Duke Francis now, which might actually prove to be a mistake. But both Francis and Charles VIII clearly thought that having a pretender trying to cause trouble in the land of the old enemy was generally a pretty fab idea. So, where was Margaret in all of this? We don't know where she was physically, maybe London, or more likely the northwest. But what we do know is that her husband wasn't with her. The domestic arrangements of Stanley and Margaret are most intriguing to me. So on this occasion, Stanley remained loyal to Richard and was with him at Salisbury, Did he and Margaret have a plan which involved Stanley being the decoy while Margaret plotted? Or did Margaret keep all of this plotting quiet somehow, even from Stanley, which would seem tricky to be fair, but maybe not impossible? It seems that Richard didn't know immediately about Margaret's role, but he soon did. And if John Fisher was correct about her being a bit of a worrywart and expecting the worst and planning for the frankly catastrophic, she'd have presumably been chewing her nails. Her partners in crime either fled, like John Morton and the Marquis of Dorset, or took sanctuary, like Elizabeth, or were arrested and thrown in the chokey, like the go-between, Dr. Lewis. Quite probably, Margaret had an idea of what was coming through her husband, but it all became clear in the January 1481 Parliament. Bills of attainder were passed against all the major rebels, Morton, Dorset, Wells, and of course, Henry Tudor. Margaret had her very own condemnation, and even if Richard was bigging things up, the charge list was extensive. Communicating with Henry, spreading money around to foment rebellion, plotting the destruction of the king. Now, there has been some debate about the severity of the punishment then meted out to Margaret. It has been described on the one hand as surprisingly lenient, but also, on the other hand, as very much the opposite, excessively severe. A later servant wrote, "In King Richard's days, she was often in jeopardy of her life, and yet she bare patiently all trouble in such wise." But was Margaret really in jeopardy of her life? Despite the dramatic leap in political revenge and execution through the Wars of the Roses, women were almost never executed. In fact, I'm struggling to remember any. Margaret was probably in no danger at any point of execution. In addition, of course, Stanley was in high favour with Richard, being showered with new offices in gratitude for staying by his side. So the conversation, "Thanks, Stanley, for staying loyal to me. Oh, by the way, I've executed your wife," is difficult to visualise. In that context, Margaret's punishment was pretty tough. All her lands were taken from her and given to her husband. If Stanley were to die, Margaret would very probably have been required to kiss them goodbye permanently. The one mercy, really, was that she was not incarcerated in the Tower or some such, but was allowed to be put under confinement by her husband at Knowsley and Latham, probably. But she was also not allowed to travel. All of this was not life-threatening, but it was enormously humiliating. All her life, Margaret had managed to exercise control over her life and future in the context of all the constraints that she and other women faced. Now she was, by law with her name on it, to be made powerless, and indeed for any freedom of action entirely dependent on the attitude of her husband. She had been publicly disgraced and humiliated, and shorn of control over her future. She may not have been in danger of death, but this would certainly count as the lowest point of her life. 1483 wasn't exactly a great year for Henry Tudor, any more than it was for his mum. He traipsed mournfully across Normandy and into Brittany to the fair town of Vannes, where the first bit of news that he heard was that Buckingham had been executed. "Sic transit gloria mundi, buckers," he might have remarked miserably to himself, chewing on life's gristle. But when he managed to whistle, his perspective began to change, because various very important rebels began to arrive in town, presumably mud splattered from all the frantic riding and covered in bark from all the hiding in trees. John Morton and Elizabeth Woodville's son, the Marquis of Dorset, to name but two of the most important. Meanwhile, Duke Francis continued in his Mr. Helpful Positive persona and agreed when Henry asked him to pledge aid should he try to claim his throne encore une fois, gov. At Christmas, he and his merry band of brothers swore an oath together, and Henry swore that if he became king, he would marry Elizabeth of York, an offer designed to keep on side all the rebels of Henry IV's old household who had survived the 1483 uprising. Elizabeth of York was not consulted. Of Margaret in the next 2 years, we know very little indeed again. But there are straws blowing in the wind, along with all those answers Bob was looking for. One is that it is highly likely she was writing to her lad. None of the letters survive, but it seems that Stanley, fulfilling his dual role as jailer and husband, allowed her a good deal of latitude without doing so much that he would arouse the king's ire. And a ballad suggests that Elizabeth Woodville, in her heart, remained on Team Henry, whatever her public behaviour, and added her words to those of Margaret to try and bring Stanley around to Henry's side. Now Richard was well aware of the dangers, and his actions confirm the increasing desperation of his fears. The contemporary Polydore Virgil, historian if you are Team Tudor, Tudor apologist if you are a Ricardian, wrote that Richard was vexed, wrestled, and tormented in mind with fear almost perpetually. Also, he suffered a horrible blow, the death of his and Anne's only son, Edward. The couple were at Nottingham when they heard, and became almost out of their minds for a long time when faced with such sudden grief, as you would. Within a year, Richard would also lose his wife. At the time, the various Tudor historians talked of rumours that Richard had poisoned her so that he could marry again. There is no proof of such a thing. You can make your own choice. I'm choosing not to believe it, and to feel sorry for Richard and Anne's loss, which must have been awful. Richard, however, was not the kind of guy to sit around chewing his lip, waiting for things to happen. He was a man of action. What his regime needed was legitimacy and stability. His first step was to persuade Elizabeth to come out of Westminster Abbey and join him at court. For Elizabeth, the equation was that she could not stay in sanctuary indefinitely, and she owed it to her daughters to normalise their lives. So, after Richard swore a public oath to do her no harm, she rejoined court. And by the sound of things, to her daughter Elizabeth of York's great enjoyment in the Christmas of 1484. Still, the real problem was out of Richard's reach in Brittany, and apparently in high favour with the Duke. So Richard shows us now his regnal chops, if I can put it that way. He needed to find a way to change Francis's attitude. He needed to find leverage. Now, part of that leverage came from France, where Anne of Beaujeu was regent for her young son, and began to put pressure on Francis, eager to make sure Brittany became French. And meanwhile, Richard chose this very time to respond to Breton piracy, which is something of a constant in the medieval world. He let his very own pirates off the leash, commissioning them to visit fire and sword on Breton shipping and ports. And it worked. By the latter part of 1484, Brittany was suffering badly, and Francis wanted it to end, please. At the same time, though, Richard offered the hand of friendship. Oh, sorry about those Cornish. I do try to stop their old tricks. But how are you doing with France? You must be worried about them. By playing on these fears and providing 3,000 English archers to help, Richard both pressurised Francis and showed him the advantages of alliance. Set against that, how valuable really was his support for Henry, who had already tried and failed to seize his throne, the loser. So Henry came as close to disaster in 1484 as he had ever been. Francis, and maybe more specifically his chancellor, Landois, actually agreed in secret to Richard to hand Henry over. Enter Christopher Urswick, envoy of Margaret. Somehow Margaret came to know of these wicked, wicked plans, and you have to guess that the news came from Stanley, further evidence that the Stanley rat was leaving the sinking Yorkist ship. Urswick came to Brittany, met with John Morton, and thence to Henry. He was in direct danger now. He must fly for France. Fly, you fool. Together, Henry and the ever-faithful Jasper made their plans to escape. Urswick firstly was sent on a clandestine mission to France to gain permission to enter France, which was quickly given. In the late summer, Jasper Tudor left the Breton town of Vannes, apparently on his way to meet with Duke Francis. Presumably, he was whistling casually as he went. But when he came near the French border, he legged it as hard as he could over the border into Anjou in France. 2 days later, Henry Tudor left Vannes with just 5 servants, saying that he was going to meet a friend. Presumably, he was also whistling casually. And when he neared the border, guess what? He too lifted his skirts, showed his hairy knees, and legged it over the border. Too late, the Bretons realised what was going on. They sent men in hot pursuit, but Henry was over the border just an hour before they caught up, daring do or what. By October 1484, Henry was safely ensconced in the French court, and negotiations began. At this point, Duke Francis appeared to wash his hands of the whole affair and let the rest of Henry's supporters leave and go to Paris too, on the grounds that they were eating him out of house and home. Richard must have been apoplectic with rage. So close, so unlucky. By 1485 then, Richard knew full well that he could expect an invasion from Henry, and his power to prevent it was slight. All he could do was prepare. And in fact, he probably now welcomed the coming challenge. Only by defeating Henry in battle could his legitimacy be won. On the 7th of December 1484, he issued a proclamation denouncing Henry and his invaders. Henry, meanwhile, was flooding England and Wales with letters seeking support. At the top of the list would have been 2 of Richard's most powerful magnates, Henry Percy, Earl of Northumberland, and, of course, the Stanley brothers, Thomas and William. Henry had already received a boost when John de Vere, Earl of Oxford, left Ham Castle near Calais to come and join him, to be duly rewarded with the position of commander for the expedition. Meanwhile, the French were accommodating, without being wildly so, but loaning him money and allowing him to recruit. And right at the end of July 1485, Jasper and Henry were ready to go with their intrepid band. Or motley crew might be a better description of some French soldiers, English exiles, Norman villains scraped from the prisons. And so on the 7th of August 1485, Henry and his band of probably 4,000 warriors and cutthroats landed near Milford Haven on the coast of Wales. Henry jumped into the surf when they arrived and did the traditional ground kissing for the cameras. After he'd wiped the sand from his lips, which you never really get rid of, do you, if my experience of beach holidays is anything to go by. The obvious route was then along the south of Wales, straight towards the prize, London. But instead, Henry took a much harder route, north along the west coast of Wales. You might ask why, and presumably it was because Richard had loyal supporters in South Wales, and until he could increase the size of his army, Henry would have wanted to avoid conflict. Richard, meanwhile, probably found out that the moment of truth had arrived around 11th of August 1485. Letters and commands were sent to Percy, Norfolk and Stanley in particular, as well as to his own men, to assemble at Nottingham in the English Midlands. Henry arrived at his first major town, Shrewsbury. Into history steps the valiant and true bailiff of the town, one Thomas Mitton. Bravely, Mitton lowered the portcullis, and he refused entrance to the rebel Henry, declaring grandly with a great oath that they would have to walk over his belly before he allowed them in. Sadly for Mitton, the citizens of Shrewsbury didn't like the sound of this, and they took Mitton off to one side and burnt his ears for him. And before you could say abject and humiliating surrender, Henry and his army were marching gaily through Shrewsbury. Thomas Mitton, meanwhile, lay down in the muddy street, belly to the air, so that Henry could indeed step over his belly as he had vowed. Mitton's honour was thus duly preserved, though not his dignity. By the 21st of August, Henry was at Atherstone in the Midlands of England, stepping on the old Roman road of Watling Street, which said southeast towards London, and was just 20 miles from Leicester, City of Dreams. And it was at Leicester that Richard had assembled his forces on the 21st of August. As far as he could see, Richard had scored 2 out of 3. Both Howard and Percy had arrived for him. Richard had on paper a pretty decent army then, and pretty good odds. At least 7,000 men to Henry's probably 5,000, and quite possibly Richard had even more. Now, obviously the Stanleys were proving a bit of a problem. They were still floating around the area, not showing any obvious signs of which way they were planning to jump. But as he set out to meet Henry in battle, Richard would have been pretty comfortable. Certainly, there were no signs of any large-scale desertion, and by the evening of the 21st, the two armies were ready for battle the following day. But on the morning of the 22nd of August, poor old Richard looked like death warmed up, plagued apparently by terrible dreams and demons. But what is clear is that Richard wanted this battle. And indeed, he needed this battle every bit as much as did Henry Tudor. Meanwhile, as Howard, Duke of Norfolk, came out of his tent in the cold light of dawn, he found a friendly note waiting for him. "Jack of Norfolk, be not too bold, for Dickon thy master is bought and sold." Howard, however, was to prove every bit as resolute as was Richard. So Richard arranged his army in battles, with Howard commanding the vanguard. The position of Percy is quite interesting, but he and his contingent appears to have been left out on the left in some way. Richard must have been constantly plagued by doubts. Would Percy remain loyal when they arrived at Le Crunch? Of the Stanleys, Richard appears to have made up his mind, in fact. Famously, he has supposed to have demanded Stanley declare himself and threatened to kill his son, who he held Lord Strange. And he received from Stanley the reply that Stanley had other sons, so do your worst. Richard did indeed apparently order the worst, ordering his men to behead Lord Strange, but the order wasn't carried out. As it happens, the Stanleys were still playing both ends at this very late stage. Henry's urgent inquiries got no more satisfaction than did Richard's. The Stanleys were playing for time. Henry's army of exiles, Welsh, French, Scots, came on, skirting round the marsh to attack Howard in one mass battle. They were peppered by Richard's artillery and handgunners. Any notion that Richard was poorly prepared should be ignored. Plenty of ammunition of both types had been found on the battlefield. But then Richard gave the command, and Howard charged down the rise into Oxford vanguard, and the vicious business of hand-to-hand fighting began, pike and billhook, sword and axe and dagger. It seems as though Oxford ordered his men into tight groups around standards, and in the press this concentration of people seemed to work, and they began to gain the advantage. Either that, or it was just bad luck that Howard was killed. And anyway, that in itself can't have helped morale for the Yorkists. So the fight was hard, but for some reason, Richard was unable to deploy Percy's battle, and Percy's battle contained most of Richard's northerners, his most committed supporters. Now this might be for two reasons. One, it could be that the marsh now prevented Percy from joining, blocking him, so that the only way for him to join the battle would have been to actually go through Howard's battle. Or it could be treachery. It could be that Henry's letters and blandishments had done their work. At this point, Henry put himself in great danger. He and his small personal guard became exposed. Either he had simply become disconnected from the main army as Oxford pushed forward, or maybe even he had decided to ride to William Stanley to entreat him to join and swing the battle in his favour. On his hill then, Richard and his cavalry saw an opportunity. If he could charge and kill Henry now, the battle would without doubt end in triumph. If he killed Henry, the judgment of God could not be clearer. Plus, it could be that the main battle was going against him. Certainly, his most trustworthy supporter was dead, Percy's loyalty uncertain. But by attacking Henry directly, he would expose himself to horrible danger, disconnected from the rest of his men and right in front of the Stanley's position. If their loyalty did indeed not hold, he would be in horrendous danger. He stood on the edge of a cliff, danger and opportunity fighting for supremacy in his mind. And as he'd done in 1483, Richard rolled the dice. "This day I will die as a king or win," he roared, and kicked his horse into action, and with the men around him ordered the charge, the gold circlet on his crown gleaming as he rode. Richard led his cavalry and slammed into the exposed Henry with vicious speed and weight of horse metal. They hit and carried all before them. Richard's path to Henry was blocked by a massive knight, John Chaney, but Richard hacked him down, chewing through Henry's guard. William Brandon was cut down, and Henry's standard fell, and to all who saw it, that must have signalled the end of Henry Tudor. But the charge was slowing, its impetus going, and Henry's men resolutely gathered around him and desperately resisted. At this point, William Stanley rolled the dice and ordered his men to charge. And the object of the charge was not Henry, but Richard. It seems likely that at this point, as the Stanleys flew towards Richard, that he did have the opportunity to run, to escape back to his army. Though with the Stanleys now committed, it was Richard that was outnumbered. But Richard was committed now. If he could just reach Henry, all could be saved. But Stanley's men hit before he could break through, and now the tables were turned. Richard's horse was killed from under him. At some point, he must have lost his helmet, and he was hit by several glancing blows that cut his scalp and took chips of bone off his skull. In agony, he fought on, but a mounted man struck down with a dagger and pierced his skull. And then came a mighty blow from a heavy-bladed weapon, which opened his skull at the base of his head, and night closed on his eyes, and he bit the dust. Whatever his crimes or triumphs, one thing nobody could take away from Richard was the heroic nature of his death. To give the last words to that arch-assassin of his reputation, Polydore Virgil, he died fighting manfully in the thickest press of his enemies. Margaret, of course, was not there, and was forced throughout Henry's march and battle to wait for news, though maybe letters went to and fro as Henry marched through Wales. Obviously, we can be reasonably sure of Margaret's joy and no doubt vast relief when the news arrived. Henry was to give her a gift, a book of hours that he took from the dead king's tent and signed by Richard. Margaret had already noted in her own book of hours, "This day, King Henry VII won the field where was slain King Richard III. Which I have to say is a rather emotionless entry. When she received Richard's signed book of hours, she permitted herself a little more latitude, erasing the name of the hated usurper who had seized the crown of her Lancastrian ancestors. And in this book she wrote, "For the honour of God and St. Edmund, pray for Margaret Richmond." All the worry, the hoping, the scheming were over. Next week, everyone, we start a new project on the British Constitution and Common Law. This came high on the voting on Facebook. But there was a significant proportion, well, one, who said, "What on earth are people voting for this for?" So do not despair. We'll keep going with Margaret. I have a number on the English and their drink for you at some point. And of course, we will restart the history of Scotland. So, if it's not your cup of tea, a bit of patience will see you right. Also, don't forget it's the omnibus for this week if you prefer a longer episode so that you can, you know, nod off more easily. Meanwhile, thank you so much for being members, everyone. It's really lovely of you. I am eternally grateful. Good luck, everyone, and have a great week.